From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. If you think the failure of FEMA during Katrina was an accident, writer Thomas Frank says, think again. He says FEMA is one of many agencies conservatives have deliberately sabotaged, driven by a core belief that government doesn't work and should thus be dismantled. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Thomas Frank about his new book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule. Also, a satirical whodunit set in the newsroom, written by a 40-year veteran of the newspaper business. We talk with John Darnton, who's been a reporter, editor, and foreign correspondent for the New York Times. His new novel is Black and White and Dead All Over. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. 4 years ago, Thomas Frank's influential book, What's the Matter with Kansas?, argued that conservatives have effectively used social issues to convince many in the heartland to vote against their economic interests. In his new book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, Frank takes on conservatives in public office. He argues that stories of incompetence in government, from Katrina relief to Reconstruction in Iraq, are no accident. He says because conservatives don't believe in government, when elected, they systematically degrade and dismantle the machinery of state. Thomas Frank is a regular columnist for The Wall Street Journal and is the founding editor of The Baffler, a journal of cultural and political criticism. Well, Thomas Frank, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your new book is about how conservatives rule, how they approach government. And you write that the conservative movement really picked up steam, the sort of grassroots conservative organizing, when conservatives found that right-wing activism could be a profitable business. You make money by doing this. How do they make money?
Yeah, that's sort of one of the critical realizations that I came to while I was doing the research for this book, was that conservatism isn't just a political movement, it's also an industry. And this is something that began in the 1970s with what's called direct mail. Your listeners might know it as junk mail, but you get those solicitations in the mail from political groups, and they're always pretty shrill and pretty outrageous, and they're asking for money on the grounds that something really, really awful is going to happen if you don't give the money. And when this first started, it was only conservatives doing it in the beginning. And your listeners might remember some of the issues, like the famous Panama Canal giveaway. But there was dozens of different ones, and this turned out to be a very lucrative business, the direct mail field. And that's sort of the beginning, in the way I see it, of conservatism as industry. It wasn't something where big business types or even small business types gave money and just lost money, put it into politics in order to further their interests. It was something. It was a form of politics that actually could make money on its own. And then defund the left was sort of the second stage in that, where conservative activists would go out and market themselves as essentially as class warriors.
One of the basic messages of your book is that when we see incompetence in government these days, it's not necessarily an accident, that it is the purpose of conservatives when they get in power to wreck the machinery of government. And you say that conservatives, beginning with Reagan and continuing since then, have systematically destroyed the civil service system. Explain how this has been done.
Well, we should start with the ideology itself. And one of the most interesting documents that I came across while I was doing the research for this book is an interview from 1928 with a guy who had been the president of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States, and he said had this sort of immortal statement that was kind of well known at the time. He said, "The best public servant is the worst one," and what he meant by that is that you shouldn't have highly qualified people in government, because that would just lead government to be effective. Then people would trust government to do things well, and government would inevitably start regulating the private sector, taking away power from the private sector, and then it's a slippery slope to communism or something like that. This is an idea that conservatives repeat all the time, that you shouldn't have the best people in government, because, as I said, they think that the private sector is more important. That's where the best and the brightest should be. And if you have really talented people in the public sector, they're going to grab for power. They're going to take power away from its rightful holders, which means, of course, business. That's the ideology of it. The practice of it during the Reagan administration, and then continuing here during the Bush administration, and I should also say, I don't want to let Clinton off the hook here either. He wasn't much better than either Reagan or Bush in this regard. But the practice has been to alienate and antagonize the federal workforce, to call them all sorts of names, especially under Reagan, where the federal workforce was supposed to be something close to devils. The conservative movement refers to them as the permanent government, and they're supposed to have, according to sort of conservative mythology, the bureaucracy is supposed to have an agenda of its own. And it's the job of conservatives to make sure that they aren't able to grab power for themselves, and they aren't able to run with their agenda. That they have to do what conservatives want. So you have to gain control over the bureaucracy. You have to crack heads. You have to bring the tanks up, as one Reagan official very famously put it.
Let's talk about how it works. How specifically would civil servants be attacked, devalued, demoralized?
Well, the best statistic that you can point to is something that they call the pay gap, or that they used to call it that. You really don't hear about it very much anymore. But back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, the government used to measure the differential in wages between public sector workers, federal bureaucrats, what they were paid and what people in the private sector doing the same work were paid. And that's how they would they did these elaborate studies on this, because that's how they decided how much to pay the federal workers. Now, one of the other things is you could look at these numbers and see that public sector workers were always paid slightly less than private sector people doing the same job. And they'd say, well, that's because public sector workers have, excellent benefits. They have job security. They have really good pension plans and that sort of thing. So it wasn't much of a problem back in the 50s and the 60s and in the 70s. And then under Reagan, the pay gap, what they called the pay gap, started to really open up wide. And by 1990, it was at something like 40% for people in the top federal jobs. Their private sector analogs were getting, people doing the same work in the private sector were making 40% more than public sector workers doing exactly the same thing. And then they changed the standard of measuring it. So now, that was in 1990. So we really don't know what it is now. I assume it's gotten much worse just based on anecdotal evidence. There's something that we have here in Washington, another great Washington term called the revolving door, where people go from the public sector into the private sector, often to do the same work, often to lobby their former colleagues, but they're paid much, much, much more in the private sector. Now, one of the other side of this coin is that conservatives believe in government by the private sector. George W. Bush, a statement of his that I refer to a lot in my new book, where he said government should be market-based. And just think about that for a second. Government should be market-based. What does he mean by that? Well, what it turns out that he means in practice is this sort of massive privatization and contracting out of federal work. So you have, at something like FEMA, at an agency like FEMA, you'll have, someone who's a federal employee sitting at one desk, and the guy sitting at the desk next to him will be the employee of some private company, and he'll just by chance, as it happens, be making, a lot more money. But he'll be working there in the same building. They'll be working on the same thing. There's one critical difference, though. The federal worker ultimately answers to you and me. The guy that works for the private contractor answers to shareholders. He answers to his boss.
In the 1990s, there was this move towards privatization of some government functions. During the Clinton administration, Al Gore headed something called Reinventing Government in state and local governments everywhere. And I think the idea was that, at least the way it was presented, was that government, when over time had become indifferent and unaccountable and inefficient, and that there were certain functions that would be better handled by private industry. How did this work out in terms of its effect on the civil service employees and on its effect on public services?
Well, contracting out is the real story of Washington, D.C. As you drive around the famous Capitol Beltway, the big highway that goes around the city, you'll see the people who really govern us, and it's not the poor bureaucrat down in the Department of Labor. It's these people in these sort of glamorous glass office buildings with the names of the great federal contractors on them, and that's who really does the business of governing now, and they do it for they make a lot more money at it than the bureaucrats. ever did. Whether or not they've done a good job, I mean, that's a pretty easy question to answer. They've done a really, really, really bad job. I mean, in the Bush administration, which has made such a push to privatize and outsource every possible federal job, you think of the three great initiatives of the Bush administration: Homeland Security, Katrina recovery, and Iraq reconstruction, and each one of these has just been the most incredible botch, and also fantastically expensive. What always gets me about the whole move for privatization and contracting was that it was supposed to, I mean, this is the fig leaf, it was supposed to save money. I mean, that was the idea. It was supposed to save the public money. And in fact, it's turned out to be just fantastically expensive. The real purpose, of course, is to, you know, hand off power away from what these people that conservatives hate, what they call the permanent government, the bureaucrats, take the power away from them and hand it over to private corporations. And those private corporations, I mean, just by, it's not a coincidence at all. Just as it happens, most of them tend to be big contributors to the Republican Party. You know, getting back to industry conservatism, they tend to be big supporters of the conservative movement industry.
We're speaking with Thomas Frank. His new book is The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Thomas Frank. His latest book is The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. You know, I have to say, as I read the book, and you were talking about how civil servants, those who over the years have devoted their lives to serving the public and the government, have been demoralized and displaced and driven out by conservatives who see that as their mission. You know, as somebody who's covered local government for 20 years, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I've seen plenty of cases, particularly in the 90s, where public-spirited folks came in, and I've known a lot of great civil servants over the years who do their jobs and do it well. But there are plenty of cases, it seems to me, where people get into a bureaucratic mentality where they can become unaccountable and indifferent to the public. And sometimes introducing some privatization gets unions, gets civil service workers to think in a different way about what they're doing, and sometimes serve the public better. I mean, do you think that any privatization initiative is driven by a conservative zeal to destroy the government?
Oh, I'm not saying every single one. You know, that certainly I'm sure there are many operations that you know that richly deserve to be privatized. For example, you know, the building of weapons. The government has never built its own weapons systems, going all the way back. But at the same time, you know, the problem these days isn't pointing out what you just said, that you know, that there are bureaucrats who don't do their jobs well and who get into a bureaucratic mentality. I mean, every third grader in America knows that. You know, that's part of the myth of the movement that has dominated our lives for the last 30 years. The really interesting thing to me is that bureaucracies do work well in a lot of situations. That's why we have them. I mean, that's why they were built in the first place. You go back to the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration, you know, one of the first, you know, giant bureaucracies the Roosevelt administration set up. And it's amazing to me how well they were able to do complex tasks, you know, put people to work. I was just up in rural Vermont, and I went into a little post office, and it had these, you know, these beautiful murals that had been painted in the 30s by the WPA. You know, they'd found some artist who was out of work, and they'd given the guy a job painting these murals. And the thing to remember nowadays is that bureaucracy does work in lots of situations. That's why we have it. It is an advanced form of getting complex tasks done.
But, you know, it seems to me there's a difference between a bureaucracy whose goal is to regulate private conduct, to make our food safer and protect the environment and permit fair rules for unionizing workplace. A difference between that and bureaucracies that deliver a service to the city, that picks up the trash, that collects its taxes, et cetera. And that there are cases in which those service delivery systems can become ossified and indifferent and unaccountable, and that shaking them up sometimes by privatizing some pieces of it actually helps. There are some functions that maybe government doesn't do so well, and I guess that's why I'm just questioning whether.
Well, that's certainly correct. Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you on that. Yeah. I mean, there certainly are many situations where that's true.
Well, you know, you write in the book. I mean, you talk about the lobbying culture, and one of the points you make is that the lobbyists are there to, in effect, turn the government over to market forces. But it struck me that this is one of the ways in which conservatism has changed over the decades, is that it seems to me that maybe many decades ago, conservatives believed in a true free market notion, that government should stay out of regulation, it should lower taxes, it should let business compete. But it seems to me that so much of this now is really based upon business interests that they don't want competition, they want a fix. They want sweetheart contracts, they want customized tax credits and bailouts and selective tariffs and little niche regulatory exemptions. In a way, they don't want government to shrink and die, they want it to feed them, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. The thing is that is conservatism in action. Conservatism has always talked laissez-faire, but it's always delivered this other thing, which is, you know, extravagant favors to private industry. And it seems like a contradiction. And in fact, there's, you know, several think tanks here in D.C. that specialize in the idea, in sort of selling the idea that the conservative movement is filled with imposters and traitors, and because nobody's ever a true conservative. Once they get into power, all they do is these sweetheart deals for private industry. But what you find is that this is what conservatism is. This is what the animal looks like in the field. This is how it behaves. This is always what it does. This is as laissez-faire as you're going to get. These, you know, no-bid contracts for Lockheed Martin or whatever the hell it is.
You know, one of the interesting things about your book is the language that you use. It at times reads like a rant on a block. I mean, you describe Duke Cunningham, the congressman who was convicted and I believe sentenced to 8 years on corruption charges, as a conservative of distinctly Neanderthal tendency. And at one point you use the phrase, the wingnuts and chiselers who have been our subjects thus far. It's funny. But
chiseler is a great word. That's not a blog word. That's a 19th century word. That word needs to be brought back.
Right. Okay.
I'm not a blogger. I don't blog. I do.
I guess what I'm getting at is, I mean, a lot of people talk about kind of the poisonous atmosphere of partisanship in Washington and the need to have reasoned civil discussion of ideas. You're really swinging for the fences with this stuff.
Well, come on, Duke Cunningham. The guy is, I mean, there. He's as disgraced as they
disgraced
get.
His office, but was a decorated Navy pilot nonetheless.
That's true. That's true. And as a kid, I thought he was hot stuff. I've changed my mind about him now. But yeah, he flew that Phantom jet. I mean, he was the greatest. I mean, it's a real letdown. I mean, a lot of the people that I met with and that I interviewed are very sophisticated, you know, highly intelligent people. You know, you think of a guy like Grover Norquist, very, very smart guy. Or you think of a man like Richard Viguerie, who's associated with Direct Mail, an honorable fellow, you know, a convincing, fatherly. I like the guy. There's a lot of conservatives that I'm very fond of. I think it's totally fair game to go after Duke Cunningham. But let me just add, the language of blogs, that's not me. My language is, it's straight out of, you know, 1930s, 1920s, 19-teens muckraking literature. That's what I come from.
You know, I wanted
you're
to ask
you. You're going to say, hey, Frank, you were born in 1965. And now, but it's that's what I read. I mean, that's what I spend my spare time reading. And I think to call somebody a mountebank when they are one is perfectly fair.
And explain that for our listeners.
Yeah. A mountebank?
Yeah, I forgot. That's
a fraud.
Right, right. You know, your last book, What's the Matter with Kansas, was about how some voters were persuaded, you believe, to vote against their own economic interest. I'm wondering how some of the political currents that you saw in that book are playing out in this election.
I think that the idea in What's the Matter with Kansas was that culture war issues had come to take the place of class issues, because, you know, the culture war issues are always framed in terms of class, and we see the Republicans desperately trying to use this language to beat Obama. You know, they're always talking about him as a liberal elitist and running through the sort of the list of stereotypes. And what's very interesting to me this time around is that it's not working. It's not sticking to him. And in many other respects, the culture war issues are failing this time around. And I think that could be because the economic situation is so much more dire now that it's impossible to brush it off and say, you know, the real class villain in America is intellectuals or something like that. It's just nobody's going to buy that when gas is $4 a gallon and you can't afford, you know, milk for the kids and stuff like that.
Thomas Frank, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Thomas Frank's new book is The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, whose four-day poetry festival starts September 25th in Waterloo Village, New Jersey, at dodgepoetryfestival.org. And from Dial Press, publisher of The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society, by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows, about friendship and the power of the written word. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A powerful editor is found murdered in the newsroom of a dying institution, the Metropolitan Newspaper. Coming up, we talk with John Darnton, author of a new satirical novel, Black and White and Dead All Over. Darnton is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of several books. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Newspaper journalists aren't a happy bunch these days. With papers feeling financial pressure from the internet and other new media, reporters are being laid off in droves, and those left behind often complain about staff shortages and editors who care only about fluff. So what happens if one day, right on the floor of a venerable publication's newsroom, an unpopular editor turns up dead? lying in a pool of blood with an editor's spike in his chest. That's the opening of a new novel by my guest, John Darnton. Darnton worked for 40 years at the New York Times, winning a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Poland. Darnton's new book, Black and White and Dead All Over, is his fifth novel and the first about the newspaper business. Well, John Darnton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the business as we see it in this book. It opens with a ghastly murder of an editor. In the newsroom, we discover a body with an editor's spike in it lying in a pool of blood on the floor. And, of course, the police get involved. And we see this unfold through the reporter who is assigned to cover it, Jude Hurley. But also we see the what's interesting is as the police investigate this, we get an outsider's look at the news media. And very early on, there's a scene in which the police detective assigned to the crime goes to a news planning meeting, the daily meeting of editors over what's going to happen in the paper. And I sense that this is your way to kind of open up the bowels of the news business to an outsider.
I confess to that. You've caught me there. I don't know how many of these news meetings I've been to. In my life, I bounced back and forth across the net between reporter and editor, but I would say maybe 10 years worth of news meetings. So you get to know the rituals of it. You get to know how people try and sharpen their elbows a little and step on each other, bigfoot them, if you will. You know when the wind is sweeping one way and when it's moving the other way. You can see in the space of a 45, 50-minute meeting all these wonderful joustings of egos and careers that are rising and falling. So it's a lot of fun. And then it's just a good way to show how decisions are made about the front page. These are, by and large, front page meetings where the top editors sit around with desk editors who pitch their story. So it's a very vivid kind of forum, you know, to see all these kinds of contending egos.
Right. And so we see these editors undercutting one another and puffing themselves up. We also see in this meeting some of the values that are not so inspiring that govern decisions. For example, we've got somebody who has a wonderful story about a priest doing good work in the slums of Boston. And you have the editor, the executive editor, Skeeter Diamond, shoot the idea down. Why?
Well, because Skeeter Diamond says, you know, this is not the time for that kind of story. That's a positive priest story. We're in the midst of a scandal here. And to keep a scandal going, you know, you have to kind of you have to feed the beast. You can't just let it die out by printing a story that runs against a scandal. I have to say, Dave, that is a true incident. That actually happened.
That happened at the newspaper you were associated with, the New York Times?
Yeah. So you can use, you know, maybe in a slightly exaggerated form, but you can use reality, give it a tweak, and it turns into satire. It didn't happen like that. It didn't happen quite so publicly. But those things occasionally under bad leadership, and this was many, many years ago, they are a sign of a paper in distress when decisions are made for the wrong reasons.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the newspaper in your book, The New York Globe, which, of course, in your story, has a murderer loose within the building. Tell us about the basement of the building.
Well, this is set in the New York Globe, which is between 7th and 8th Avenue and 45th Street, unlike the old New York Times, which was between 7th and 8th Avenue and 43rd Street. In the old New York Times, there was a period in which the presses were taken out of the basement. There used to be a basement, a sub-basement, and kind of a sub-sub-basement. And it was a wonderful thing to go down there when the presses were running. You know, the whole room was shaking. It was this underground cavern. You had the pressmen with their little hats formed, you know, of paper, very complicated hats that only they could learn how to make. And when you were reporting, you would come back to the office in the afternoon, and at a certain point, Usually it was around between 3 and 4 p.m., these gigantic trucks would pull up with these rolls of newsprint, of the paper it's going to be printed on, and these rolls would come tumbling down the back of the truck and strike the back of the loading bay, and the whole building would shake like a little minor earthquake. And that was like a reminder. When you felt that shaking, you kind of felt your stomach shake because you knew you had to begin to sit down and write on deadline. You only had 3 or 3.5 hours to get it in.
You're sitting at your desk on the third floor. You feel this rumble.
You feel this rumble down beneath you, and it's a kind of reminder that this is a daily operation. You better get going. That's a great immediacy to have the paper sort of printed right in your own basement. And then it comes up at 10 after 10. The pages are still hot. The ink is runny. And you tear through it. You look for your story. And you can complain. And you can pretend you don't read your story, whatever you want to do. It all changed. The mood changed a little bit when the printing presses went out to Queens. And then they changed, of course, even more when we went from so-called hot type, where there were linotype machines that were basically duplicating the typing that you did as a reporter to get your piece into kind of hot lead, into cold type and into the offset printing process, and the whole composing room changed. So the technologies the change in technology was immense, and that kind of really changes the feel of it.
And in a newspaper in which the printing has moved out of the building, as it did at the Globe, when someone descends to that basement now, they see, in effect, a cavern the size of a football
field. Just a huge cavern that extends 3 stories down. You could still see in some places the conveyor belts where the old papers used to kind of come running up and across and above you the way it does in every old Humphrey Bogart movie, and where the editor can yell stop the presses. It's a very kind of nostalgic scene that's almost embedded, you know, in our unconsciousness as American citizens. This, of course, has all changed, and now the New York Times, for one, has moved into a new, brand new skyscraper, which is a beautiful building designed by Renzo Piano, 3 blocks to the south. It's got a different feel.
There are some wonderful characters in here. One of them is the publisher, Elisha Hagenbuckle. Tell us a bit about him.
Well, he is, I like to think of him as, he's described as a man who knows how to speak power to truth. That is, he's got the power. He's absolutely clueless about what to do with it. He's married into his position, and he always compares himself to kind of the head of an aircraft carrier standing on the bridge, and in the book it said that it's as if he thinks he's keeping the ship afloat, but he has no idea really that it's the ocean under him. And he's a big game hunter. He's meant to be a foolish man, and I think he is. He is not at all based on the publisher of the New York Times, who is very different in almost every way.
His great rival is a tabloid publisher, an Australian named Lester Mollach.
He's New Zealander.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm right.
Yeah.
New Zealander.
So okay. Totally different from the person you're probably thinking
totally
of.
Different from Rupert Murdoch, who's from Australia. Tell us a little bit about the tabloid that this New Zealand publisher, Lester Mollach, is putting out, and kind of the values it represents, and mm-hmm. where it is in the news business in the world that you painted.
Yeah, he puts out a tabloid called the New York Graphic. And the reporters call the Graphic the grifter. They have nicknames for the different tabloids. The New York Mail, they call the Mall, M-A-U-L. And basically, this New Zealander uses his tabloid to advance his own political power and prestige. So he's always using it to try and undercut the New York Globe, which he sees as his main rival, even though the Globe is a paper with a very long and storied history and a broadsheet that's very serious and believes in high quality news.
And of course, the publisher of both the New York Globe and the tabloids belong to the Executives Association, which has a lovely name in your book. You must share that with us.
Nope. Yes, nope. News Owners Publishers Editors Association or something. Yeah.
Nope. Which shares techniques on how to cut costs and get early retirements among their staff.
And one of my favorite scenes in the book is they're all these high-flying publishers and editors are treated to a lecture by a young 14-year-old blogger who runs a blog called TeenageSnivel.com that's extremely popular, getting well over a million hits. And she explains, she comes up sort of, you know, with a pierced navel and chewing gum and kind of everything else and just explains what she does, how she writes about, you know, her dream when she gets up and what she has for breakfast. And then she comes home from school and talks with a friend on the phone and then maybe goes to bed. And then, you know, and these editors are just baffled at this new world where something like that could become so popular. It just represents everything that is defeating them and that they don't understand.
And in your book, this teenage blogger who's still in school and basically just puts her chatter on there in a lively way has gotten a new $2 million contract.
Yes.
Is this your nightmare of where the business is headed?
Well, I don't know if it'll get that. Yes, to be sure, yes. I do have to say I've been following the blogs, especially during the political campaign, and it's fascinating. They are, for what they do, they're just unparalleled. I mean, they're great for verification. You can catch if Dan Rather does something wrong, you know, there are 1,000 experts or semi-experts out there who will instantly catch him. They're good at sort of aggregation, what I think of as aggregation. They're very good for expressing opinion, but what they're not good at is digging down and giving you news, real hard news. And they all they depend on the news to do what they do. They can't operate in a total vacuum. So, when they get up and sit there in their pajamas and begin to type what they think of things, they have to have things to think about. And that comes from newspapers.
We're speaking with John Darnton. His new book about a murder at a newspaper is called Black and White and Dead All Over. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is former New York Times reporter and editor John Darnton. His new book about a murder at a newspaper is called Black and White and Dead All Over. I wanted to talk about a couple of the other touches of the profession that are portrayed in the book. One of them is the bar around the corner from the paper where folks gather after work. Was that a regular ritual when you were at the Times? Describe the scene there.
The real bar is called Goff's. In my book, it's Slough's. There was, in fact, a painting of, I don't think it was Joe Louis beating Max Schmeling, but it was some key moment of boxing history that was so covered over with cigarette smoke and dirt that you couldn't see anything in it, but basically a brown canvas. There was a pressmen drank in there quite a bit. And reporters and editors, lower level editors, went there. The higher paid talent went to Sardi's, which was one street up. And bars, of course, are part of the mystique of newspapers and have been ever since they began, as far as I know. So that in the old days, if a major story broke after 9 o'clock, an editor could just place a call to a bar across the street and line up some reporters and bring them back in and send them out to work the story. It was a wonderful way of keeping your staff kind of close at hand.
Is it different now that reporters are college guys that aspire to suburban living?
Because basically in those days, the other part of the equation is they were mostly men, the reporters. Right. In fact, when I began at the Times, there was one woman on the local staff, on the Metro staff. There were some coming up on my level with me, but actual full-fledged reporters, I think there was one. In the Metro staff, I don't mean Style and other parts of the paper. So these were single men. They weren't in a hurry to go home necessarily. And there was this still kind of adrenaline rush that they often felt after writing a story on Deadline. And they'd want to go and just walk across the street and tell a few lies about how they got it or keep each other amused. It's very different when people move out into the suburbs and when they're on train schedules. And the newspaper clears out. In the old days, when I began, you know, you had to approach the city editor for your good night, and you would stay there until he turned to you and looked you in the eye and said good night. Now, I noticed I was Metro editor for a while, and by this point, people were already kind of leaving when their workday was done, when they thought it was done. And we tried to reinstitute the good night as a kind of a managerial tool, and it just didn't work because people had to dash off to catch a train to, you know, Pelham or something like that. Now, I don't mean to be a total nostalgist. There were a lot of things clearly about the old days that weren't good, but there was a kind of spirit there, too, that was extremely important, which can get lost in a larger sort of faceless bureaucracy in which a lot of the beginning reporters are recruited, say, from the Ivy League instead of just from people in the area.
Your father was a war correspondent. I mean, you really grew mm-hmm. up in the business and was killed in action in World War II, right?
Yes. He was in fact a war correspondent for the New York Times, and was killed in October 1942 off the coast of New Guinea when he was covering a kind of an advanced landing party of American troops from the 32nd Division, a division he had fought in World War One.
And then there's this fascinating story of him being honored by having, was it a merchant marine vessel named after him?
Yes, Liberty Ship. During the war, of course, they had to move war material, so they named a Liberty ship after him, the SS Byron Darnton. His nickname was Barney. Everyone called him Barney, but there was this ship, and my mother got to christen it with smashing the bottle of champagne on it, and my brother and I were there, although neither of us really remembers this ceremony because we were too young.
And then the ship eventually sank right off an island somewhere, right?
The ship was very somehow important to our family growing up. That is to say, we had a watercolored painting of it. We visited it once when it was in the New York Harbor before it went overseas, and we donated a music library. They gave us a wonderful tour of it, and served us a meal in the officer's mess and all of this. Then it went off to war, and it did the very deadly Murmansk run from kind of Scotland up to the port of Murmansk, carrying supplies to the Russian front, and survived and was coming on its return voyage and hit a huge gale just off the coast of Scotland and ran aground, smashed into. Everybody was saved just at the last minute and ran aground. And then we kind of lost track of it. I mean, it was gone. We didn't think of it very much. We put away, we had the christening bottle and everything. We just kind of put it away. My brother had a flag that was one of the few items saved from the ship that hung in his bedroom when he was growing up. And then years passed. And then my brother, who is an historian, was giving a speech in London to some British businessmen. And one of them said to him, by the way, do you know there's this pub in a little obscure island in Scotland called Sanda. The island was called Sanda. That's called the Byron Darnton. And that seems odd because your name is Darnton. And this, of course, registered with my brother, who went on the internet and called me. And turned out that was the island that the ship had struck. And the owner of the pub named it after the ship. He had no idea where the name came from. He kind of liked the sound of it. So we took our wives and went over to have a drink. And Well, it was the longest I've ever traveled for a drink, but it seemed worth it. And then we crossed over, my brother and I, the other side of the island, and there could just see a little hunk of what looked to be the hull or something still sticking out of the water, especially at low tide. So that was kind of amazing. It just, things like this happen that keep reminding you of someone that you've never known and who has had a tremendous effect on your life. I went to work for the New York Times and wanted to be a foreign correspondent for the New York Times because of him, although I didn't realize that while I was growing up. And at one point or other, my father, my mother, my brother, my wife even, all of us have worked for the New York Times. So it's kind of like, a company store, you know, we're like West Virginia coal miners or something. We can't keep away from it.
John Darnton's new book is Black and White and Dead All Over. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with veteran journalist John Darnton, whose new novel is Black and White and Dead All Over. His father, Byron Darnton, was a war correspondent for the New York Times who was killed off the coast of New Guinea in 1942. Clearly, you were destined to be a journalist. What stories did you hear about your father? How do you think that that calling for journalism was transmitted from his life and career to yours?
Oh, well, it was very direct and very clear. I was 11 months old at the time, so I have no memory whatsoever. My brother was 2.5 years older than I was. And in fact, he was the one who was supposed to be the journalist. He was the one to pick up the mantle and tried it for a while and did not like it. But we were told, my mother never remarried, and we were told in no uncertain terms basically that he had given his life for the country and within that for the right of people to know, for freedom of the press, that it was very important that he went, that he volunteered to go because he believed so strongly in the principle of a people's right to know. So this very strong kind of, I think families that undergo tragedy evolve kind of myths or narratives to explain the loss. And they gain in power when you're very young and you take them aboard without thinking about them because they've got a kind of an emotional weight to them. It makes everything more or less understandable, your relation to the world, and you become a very tight-knit, in our case, a threesome. And there are certain founding principles that you operate on. So it's as if you are born with that innate sense that newspapers are extremely important because that's what the sacrifice was all about.
And how fitting that your Pulitzer Prize was earned covering the Solidarity Movement in Poland, which was all about striving for a more open society.
Yeah, and censorship. I did this satire as a kind of avoidance book. The book I was avoiding, the one I've signed the contract for, is a book about my father and investigating his life, then the life that our family led once he was killed, and how that does shape someone, totally inform someone, and how kind of a mythic stature can really exert such a powerful influence over your whole life. So that's the book I have to get to now.
Of course, you must have read a lot of the stuff that your father filed.
Yes.
What was it like?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. My son, when he was about 20, compiled a book of all of his clips, because you can now get them. You know, you can go back. That's, again, the wonder of the internet. And he compiled them all in chronological order. So I sat down and read them all. The style was very different. It was a wonderful style, much more informal, believe it or not. And, of course, this was the war dispatches are a mixture of humor. He would say, our boys, for example, which you can't imagine that today, you know, our boys over here say or feel. It was a kind of almost a Hemingway-esque Steinbeck sort of style. You know, there wasn't a fear of repeating certain words and a kind of nice rhythm to the sentences. In particular, he wrote a final dispatch, a very long one, in which I presume an editor in New York asked him to compare this war with the World War I, where he had fought as a doughboy in the 32nd Division. And he just lets himself go. And at the end, there's a stirring tribute where he says, you know, you can walk up to the aerodrome and see the planes come in, and you know these young pilots are building a better world. And, you know, it's a powerful, powerful stuff, I think. Totally subjective. And yet newspapers, you know, in wartime then, when it was a kind of common cause, that's what people wanted to read, and that's what that was the kind of inspirational message behind what correspondents were doing.
John Darnton, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
John Darnton's new novel is Black and White and Dead All Over. You can download podcasts of our show at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press, publisher of The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows, about friendship and the power of the written word. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Music Performance Fund, striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of public concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Sir Ben Kingsley. He was inspiring in the title role of Gandhi and terrifying as a twisted thug in the film Sexy Beast. In the new movie Elegy, Kingsley's an aging professor in love with a student, and he's a pot-smoking psychiatrist who treats a teenage drug dealer in The Whackness. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.